Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Hey everyone, welcome to Roadcase. Welcome back to our regular listeners, and welcome if you're here for the first time. I'm really excited to have Eric Renner Brown with me to talk about live music, live shows, and the return, hopefully soon, to full capacity live shows in the very near future. I really encourage everyone to get involved with the Roadcase community. I'm so happy that you're here. Would love to hear from you. And ways that you can get involved is to email me, your host, Josh Rosenberg. My email is info@roadcasepod.com. Say hi, give me a suggestion for guests, or just check in and say hey. Other ways that you can get involved is to follow Roadcase Podcast on the socials. The handle is at Roadcase Pod. We also have a YouTube channel called Roadcase Podcast. And another great way to help support Roadcase Podcast, if you're so inclined to do so, is to subscribe to Roadcase. You can find Roadcase, as you already know, because you're there at your favorite listening platform. And when you're there, if you could subscribe to the podcast and even rate and review, that would be absolutely awesome. Again, appreciate each and every one of you for being here and for listening to Roadcase. So this week, I'm really psyched to have Eric Renner Brown, my interview with him. He's a editor at the live music trade publication Polestar. I interviewed him in the beginning of May, and I listened back to this interview, and it's amazing how quickly things are changing in this industry. It's an interesting interview because we talk about everything that led up to that point and the complications and et cetera involved in getting this live music world back online. And it's really fascinating to see where we were only a short 4 or 5 weeks ago. It's not outlandish to kind of look at where we were and where we're going at that time. And we weren't too far off, I'd have to say, in what we were kind of positing at the time could be the case where we are now. I know that sounds a little complicated, but here we are now. It's a really great interview. We talk a lot about different shows, where Eric's been, what he covers, his life in journalism, and we kind of kibitz and talk back and forth a little bit about live shows that we've all seen. He's a youngster compared to me, but he is a deadhead. He loves the Dead. He loves jam bands, among other things. And that's one of the things that we get along about is the diversity of our musical interests and interest in seeing different bands and such. He's out there on the forefront. He talks to everybody, and he's a great guy to have on the show. I'm so grateful that he was here. Thanks again for tuning into Roadcase. Thanks to Eric Renner Brown for being here for this episode, and here we go. Okay, hi Eric. Thanks for being here today with me on Roadcase, man. Good to see you.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, man. So you said you're joining me from Brooklyn, right? How long have you been in Brooklyn? Are you there? Are you originally from New York?
I'm from the Bay Area. Bay, Union City, by Fremont, Oakland.
We didn't even cover that. I was born there in Berkeley, and I'm from California originally. So
no way.
Born
and raised in the East Bay.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I actually went to school at Northwestern outside of Chicago, and now I find myself here in Brooklyn. Huh. I've been here for 6 years. So.
Oh, okay. God, we didn't even cover that. Yeah, no, I'm in Chicago. So, yeah, Northwestern just right up the road in Evanston. You enjoyed your time there?
Yeah. Not the winters as much, but...
Yeah, was that right? That was your first winter experience out of California, was coming out to Chicago and being right on the lake at Northwestern?
Yes, it was really jumping in the deep end.
Yeah, right. In the frozen deep end, that is.
Yes, yes.
But it's nice up there.
Yeah,
did you? Nice. So you work at Polestar. Did you study journalism?
Yeah, I studied journalism at Northwestern, and after graduating from there, I went and was on Entertainment Weekly's music team for about 3 years. So
okay.
Did the more consumer side, now covering the industry of Polestar.
Yeah. So you'd been in music, you'd just had a deep interest in music as an undergrad. Did you know that you wanted to kind of go into music journalism?
You know, I always had an interest in it, but I kind of never thought it would come together per se. Like in college, I interned at Sierra Magazine for the Sierra Club. I interned at Outside Magazine. Kind of, I thought I might be going into more of kind of a sciencey, outdoorsy route. That's kind of another passion of mine. Obviously, I always loved music, and then kind of applied for internship at Entertainment Weekly. Got that. They liked me. They hired me, and it all kind of unfolded from there. So
yeah, where were you based with Entertainment Weekly?
I was here in New York. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what's that vibe like? I get kind of like the gossipy entertainment a little bit vibe.
Well,
from that.
They are, they've changed a little bit since I've been there. I left in early 2018, but yeah, I mean, they're, partner publications with People. So you definitely do sometimes get some of the more gossip and personality celebrity driven stuff. Entertainment Weekly has a long lineage of, being very much like nerd oriented. So when I was there, they were kind of,
oh, so you fit in right well there.
Yeah. Yes, they kind of
I'm saying that very in a very nice, loving way, though.
I know. Thank you. But yeah, they were kind of coming out a little bit more out of the kind of deep dive nerd stuff and a little bit more into kind of mainstream celebrity driven.
Yeah,
stuff.
I mean it's a good, that Entertainment Weekly is definitely an airport buy for me for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
when I see, you know, it's like it brings you up to speed on what's going on, especially with so much streaming on TV and stuff, you know, it gives you some good orientation, a little bit of background. They cover like a story. So did you cover music there?
Yeah, so it was interesting. I mean, the TV and movies operation there is like their staffs dwarf our little small music team. It was like four or five people, but that meant that like, yeah, we didn't necessarily get as many covers from the music department, but I was on the music department, so we on such a small team was able to really do some cool interviews and stuff and interview some big albums that I might not have otherwise been able to starting out my career if I was like at Rolling Stone or something.
Right What were some of the cool interviews that you did?
I mean, Robert Plant as a classic rock.
Oh, holy
guy
shit,
was just,
man. Just why don't you
amazing.
Just start right at start at the bottom, man.
He was amazing. Lars from Metallica a couple times, Father John Misty, St. Vincent. Yeah, I mean, it was.
And was that just for background on an article, or was it just like, this is the Robert Plant interview, or Josh
pretty
Tillman
much
interview?
Yeah, catching up with people. I mean, you know, Josh Tillman was awesome. Met for an hour in the Bowery Hotel, had a whole conversation during the Pure Comedy era. Yeah, I mean, you know,
oh, I love him. I saw that show too. It was at the Chicago, the Auditorium Theater here. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty funny when I saw him on that tour in at King's Theater in Brooklyn, and at the end of the title track Pure Comedy, you know, he has that lyric, each other's all we've got or whatever, and there was it was a seated show, and there was a guy, and in front of him there was another guy standing up, and this guy was seated. And he's like screaming at the standing guy for standing up. So, you know, Josh is like, each other's all we've got. And then you just hear this guy screaming like, sit down, man, as it like goes to silence and stuff. So really kind of felt like it was set the tone.
For the complicated nature of the human experience, I guess.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw him at a seated show too for that particular run was just amazing. God, that's such a great album. It's one of my favorite albums, I'd have to say.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. God. So then you got into you transitioned to Polestar.
Yeah. So after being aired in the Weekly, I then had a brief spell doing some freelancing. Wrote for Billboard, GQ, Rolling Stone, Vulture, and then I landed at Polestar in late 2018.
Did you do, when you were freelancing, did you do it in music for those other publications?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so what is it like at Polestar? Did you start, did you immediately begin? Because you cover live music right now for them, the live music industry. What's the actual beat name, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, we are the trade magazine of the live industry. And that's pretty much what I've been covering ever since. We don't really have differentiated beats on that team. We're a pretty small team, but we all kind of divvy up everything as we go. And, just covering everything from, in normal times, tour announcements and kind of the mechanics of touring. And, for the last year, all the mechanics of not touring, I guess.
Wow. I mean, I flipped through a bunch of articles over just the past year that you had written, and it's just a sad story of just reliving. It was ugly, but it's so, what's occurred is interesting. I mean, the timeline is undeniable in that, obviously its impact on the live music industry has been like profound and indescribable, really. It's all there is, but what is that, what are your thoughts on sort of where we are right now? Let's start now, and we don't have to go over everything was canceled in March. We know.
Do you remember when everything shut down?
I do. I remember where I was at the time.
It's crazy because I remember, I've been kind of like looking at some old stuff, like a lot of, going back and like kind of looking at, it's inevitable to kind of compare where were we a year ago and stuff.
And
I saw something where it's like, I was going to be going at the end of March, 2020, I was going to be seeing Thom Yorke at Radio City. And then in June, I was going to go to a Lock-In Festival in Virginia. And I saw something like almost exactly a year ago, like mid-April, I had tweeted like, oh man, like Thom Yorke and Lock-In got postponed to the same weekend in October. Can't believe I'm going to have to choose October 2020. And little did we know. Yeah, no, it's going to be a many, many, many more months of no shows at all.
So, yeah. I mean, there was even a couple articles there about how, we're just moving them to like March, May now or something like that. That's more, that blows me away at that time. That's more like a head shaking kind of moment. Yeah.
Well, right now, where are we? We're seeing major tours get announced again, major festivals. And, we've seen some major stuff just this week. Dave Matthews Band confirmed summer touring. Chris Stapleton confirmed summer touring. I think he's kicking off his dates now at Wrigley Field on July 17th, I think. So that's would be, should it happen, that will be one of the biggest hard ticket shows since COVID. So,
and when you see these things announced, are you asking, are they providing information as to what they're doing with COVID? I noticed the one article, I didn't read every word by word every single article that you've ever written, but I really underprepared. No. I did notice, however, Margo Price did give a good deal of information. Well, at least in that article, and the Caverns are giving a decent amount of information, at least that you reported about exactly what's going to happen, that there will be pods. There'll even be a staggered socially distanced entrance with different entry times. I'm really interested in what it's really going to look like for each one of those shows. It's one thing to announce. It's one thing to say there's going to be Bonnaroo, but sort of what's Bonnaroo going to look like, or what's Ohana Fest going to look like? And is Lock-In going to even happen? What's that going to look like? And what that progression is going to look like. But I mean, let's take Chris Stapleton, for example, that's happening at Wrigley. What are you hearing about how they're going to do that show?
Well, I'll be upfront and say that I don't have inside information about this. It's speculation, but just in terms of
this is all about what you know, Eric.
just in terms of the Stapleton tour, for instance, and it's actually a similar story with the Dave Matthews Band tour, that these are dates that were announced, that they are the 2020 dates that were then postponed to 2021. In Chris Stapleton's case, they had postponed his tour to 2021, and then they took like the front few weeks of it in like June and early July and moved those to 2022 now. But the really date was, this is like July 17th, 2020. 2021, I believe, is what they announced it to be postponed to from 2020, which in that case would seem to indicate that they are planning to go forward at full capacity, or else, I mean, this.
Or else they have to, when you do the rescheduling, you're just keep punting it down the road with all those people of a full capacity show, right?
Yeah. So
if you drop that in the middle of 2021 instead of bumping in another year, obviously you have the problem that you got everybody. What do you choose people out of a hat to say, no, you can't come, you can't come, you can't?
So that's something that we've been talking about with some of these big arena tours that have been put, big arena and stadium tours that have been pushed from 20 to 2021. And now, you know, the big Run the Jewels Rage Against the Machine tour that got pushed to 2022. The big My Chemical Romance tour got pushed to 2022. I believe the Kenny Chesney Stadium tour got pushed. Then the Weekends Arena tour got pushed to 22 and got a bunch of dates added, which to us indicates that, okay, these are tours that had largely sold out before COVID happened. And the logistical nightmare of either doubling the dates in these markets to accommodate everyone, or like refunding half the tickets or however many you need to get to a certain partial capacity. A lot of people just said, we'll just go for it next year.
Yeah. I mean, what are you hearing anything more about the shows that, like Chris Stapleton, for example, that said they're doing it in 2021, or at least what do you think might happen? How the hell, they're just going to go full. I live in Chicago. They're not doing full capacity. I mean, That begs the question also of Lollapalooza. You know, I was talking with the Audio Tree people who are here locally that, you know, no one really, like, we just kind of don't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of festivals, we're really seeing, like, late August, early September really seems to be kind of the cutoff in terms of, like, the major Bonnaroos and Lollapaloozas of the world. I mean, you've got a festival like Outside Lands usually happens mid-August in San Francisco. Yeah. And they said, we're not messing with that. We're going to Halloween weekend. And, you know, Bonnaroo pushed to early September. And then you're kind of getting Austin City Limits is in there in early October. It's normal date. But I think, you know, Bottle Rock pushed to late September, I believe. In terms of festivals, we're seeing definitely it feels like people are wary about August. I think that's kind of why I was surprised with the Stapleton dates. Because, like, we've been seeing quite a few like club and theater level tours announced for September, even some arena level stuff, and then some stuff in August, but really nothing major for July. And it's kind of, I kind of don't know how it's going to shake out. I think it's anybody's guess right now. I mean, one thing that's interesting is California, and Governor Newsom said June 15th, if they continue on their trajectory, they're opening everything back up full capacity. And, you know, we're seeing the Hollywood Bowl is like responding and saying, yeah, we're looking at how we could then apply that to having, you know, larger crowds. I don't think that they're looking necessarily at full capacities, but they're definitely looking at it. And then you look at, you know, states like Texas, and they had a full house at Globe Life for the Rangers home opener. So, you know,
That's Texas though.
Yeah, right? It is.
Yeah, it depends on state by state. As you notice, like a lot of these jam band tours are going on in the Southeast right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least a good deal of them.
To see with the jam band stuff is some of the, you know, some of the socially distanced formats that are happening. I just did a big story about Billy Strings, Jamgrass, amazing Jamgrass artist. And he's been doing
I'm well familiar with him.
Yeah. And he's been doing some very interesting, innovative, dare I say, potted CD formats and, you know, all sorts of different kind of experimentation of how can we actually get people back out here in a way that is compliant with like various local.
Oh, what do you think is sort of differentiating about what Billy Strings is doing?
I think just the scale that he's doing it is impressive, and the fact that he's kind of out in front of it, in terms of some of these venues that he was doing it with are like, that was the first shows that they were doing in the potted seating format. And because throughout the pandemic, throughout the last several months, especially, we've seen like a fair amount of like, you know, acts that bring in like 200 people and they'll do their little pods and it's fine and it's good and that's happening. But to actually see an artist, you know, moving like several thousand tickets, like Billy at those podded seating formats is fascinating to see.
Yeah. I don't hear so much about drive-in shows anymore. That's kind of, that was sort of, are you?
Well, yeah. So it's interesting. I interviewed some of the folks who they're behind, this Columbia Speedway, entertainment center, they call it, in Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah. I was I was on Nugs and I just punched up an old Avett's brother and I'm like, oh, these drive-in shows, crazy. Mm-hmm.
But this,
cause that was a massive one.
Well, this Speedway, they created it. It's the same folks that did the drive-ins at Yarmouth, Cape Cod, big drive-in. Right. And that was very popular last summer. And then for this year, they started this thing at the Speedway, where it's really, it's just like a racetrack where like people go and sit in kind of these pods. It's not drive-in. And it's this like outdoor podded seating situation. And And the guys who I interviewed from that company, they were saying like, we're not doing drive-ins anymore. Like we're doing this, we're taking what we learned from the drive-ins and applying it to this, you know, cause I think that, that the drive-ins really were a pretty weird format. I mean, I didn't go to any of them. Did you?
Well, no, neither did I. No. They had a couple here close by. I had vowed just to go and ride my bike over, like, cause there was one right off the lake here near, Soldier Field. Mm-hmm. I forget what act it was. I think I don't know. I just, you know, it's not really that interesting to me, but, were they saying that they wanted to move forward because they found it such a bizarre concept of people sitting in their cars during it? Or you can sell more tickets, right? If it's not drive-in, I guess maybe.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that just the drive-in thing seems weird. Yeah. Definitely seems like a weird phenomena that I think people definitely just kind of treat it as a stopgap, but like obviously preferable to have something a little more normal.
Yeah, I had not, I did not go to one. Maybe I should have just to say that I went. I don't know. They didn't do any ones of real significance out here.
Yeah, I mean,
they did like Jeff Tweedy played at, there's one out by McHenry or something like that.
Yeah.
I might get the location wrong, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I heard about some cool ones happening out in like Anaheim. They had a big operation going on, out there. I mean, it's definitely been interesting to observe kind of, I guess the people got into it, but you know, even in our interview, I was talking to Billy and he was saying like, yeah, some of the drive-in shows that he did in like September 2020 were like, he said that, you know, he's seeing people go from pod to pod and kind of like not really understanding or caring about kind of some of the rules and stuff. So that's kind of another thing that we run into, not just with drive-ins, but with any of this kind of COVID era touring is like, is the crowd control aspect and getting people to comply.
Compliance. Yeah. I mean, people are getting loaded and just moving around and just doing what people do, right? I mean, I do think that's a factor that's not going to change, even in this pod format. I think it's just kind of personal responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase the Billy team used was like, people are at these shows and they're excited to be seeing live music again, and you know, add in a couple beers, and you know, they might not remember to you know, check their little list of all their COVID safety protocols they have to do.
Right. Yeah. I'm actually going to go see just a small outdoor show, here in town. So just a local band, just an outdoor Montrose Saloon or something. They've got something going on. So I don't know. It'll be the first live music I've heard in over a year, but, yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. But, I mean, it's old news at this point, but it is this kind of turning point of seeing how shows are going to come back come back online. You know, I talked to Bruce Finkelman, who owns the Empty Bottle in Dahlia Hall, back in December. And he was like, you know, people will come back, but we'll just kind of get closer. It's going to be 6 feet, then it's going to be 4 feet and then 3 feet, and, you know, and even when we talk about smaller venues and, you know, maybe even plexiglass separating, you know, band from fans right there. Cause you know, performers tend to effluviate quite a bit. when you're singing, you know, and if you're in the front row, I mean, you probably don't care, but I mean, you know, there's a lot. Who knows? I mean, it calls into question also the vaccine passport that I'm kind of interested in. That get kind of getting off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, the vaccine passport stuff is very fascinating, because I feel like even talking to kind of, you know, obviously there's a spectrum of liberal to conservative, you know, venue operators, promoters, yada, yada, just like anything else, there's a full spectrum of the politics. And I feel like even among some of the more liberal or progressive people in the industry, who are, you know, fully embracing all the, you know, sanitization, social distancing, contactless concessions, what have you. You hit the point with the vaccine passports and you still get some resistance even from them, because they're very concerned about guest experience and not wanting to feel invasive. And obviously they know, especially in some parts of the country, you could be alienating a huge part of the audience, a huge part of your kind of consumer base, if you say you need to flash that vaccine passport. And, you know, it's definitely a question in terms of, you know, it is your choice to be coming to the show. So like, what does it mean for that? And like, you know, if you're vaccinated, how does somebody there being unvaccinated impact you? Stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Where do you stand on that personally?
I think it's totally, you know, I wonder about some of the privacy aspects from the tech side. I don't mind so much the idea that, oh, to go to see such and such at the Garden, I'm going to have to demonstrate that I got a vaccine. In fact, you know, many of these arenas are already, you know, requiring evidence of a negative test and stuff. But I do get a little bit concerned. Like, I don't use Clear for, you know, for my air travel or anything.
Yeah, I was going to make that. I was just about to say, I do TSA pre and I have global entry, which is helpful if you're traveling internationally. You kind of dupes both at the same time, but I'm willing to give that up in order to have the convenience. And so far, no guys in black suits have been knocking at my door.
Yeah.
So I don't,
I mean, allegedly with the vaccine passport thing, it will be as simple as, you know, it's not like you're going to show up and you're going to like go through security, then have the ticket scanner. And then there's going to be like some guy in a lab coat, like checking your medical records. Like it is supposed to be like as easy as just like holding up your phone. It'll have like a green screen and that'll indicate that you're like clear to go or something. But
yeah, I'm less concerned with the privacy aspect of it. I think, I don't think I'm giving up. I'm whatever I'd be giving up in terms of privacy. I'm not an expert in that area, but me personally, I'm like, I want to go to shows and I want to feel like I'm safe at shows. And from sort of my own perspective is, if your personal interest is in being in a room, tightly packed room with 1,000 other people or more, then you should get vaccinated.
There you go. One would think, right?
But that also begs the question that, well, I'm protected now, so that's fine. But I don't know. There's also the larger societal questions of when will we get to the point where we don't, you know, where this thing goes away too. So,
and you know, it's interesting. Like, okay, so like say that you did have a vaccine passport system and you and everybody, you required 100% vaccination to enter. And so the whole audience was 100% vaccinated. Then what happens in terms of COVID era restrictions inside the venue? You know, I haven't really heard a lot about that, just in terms of like, okay, like, yeah, so say that, you know, then are you going to have full capacity? Are you going to make people wear masks? Are you going to make people stay distance? Like, kind of how did things shake out if you had the vaccine passport?
Yeah, I think it's kind of step by step. I think if there's a vaccine passport, then we see where that goes and see where people's comfort level is in wearing a mask. Right?
Well, you know, I think that there's also some questions remaining, you know, in terms of these variants and in terms of breakthrough cases. There is various like data that's like still unclear. This is part of why I'm like a little bit shaky about exactly what the prospects are for the industry coming back and when, I guess the time, not if it will come back, but kind of the timetable of it and what that might look like and what some of these safety precautions might look like, because there is still, you know, this is something that we've run into throughout COVID, is like not exactly understanding the science all the way, and that can have, you know, impacts good and bad. Like I've heard some there's been some stories over the last week or two that like actually you probably don't need to wear a mask outside anymore, like, if you're
just walking on the
sidewalk and stuff. And, you know, so that's like, that would be kind of a good thing, right? That's not as bad as we thought it was. But then there are these other ways where it's like, you know, what exactly might happen if you have a full capacity, you know, indoor arena show and everybody was vaccinated? Could something still weird happen, you know?
Yeah, and then it's such a decentralized industry, right? I mean, we're supposed to be taking marching orders from the CDC on certain things, but then you get the outliers that are moving in a direction. But then there are other shows, like I guess Electric Forest today just said, no, we're not doing 2021, we're doing 2022. So what was the driving factor there? And what was the, did you know what the driving factor
there
was?
That was an interesting one. And my friend just sent me that right before I got on with you. And
a friend just sent me that too earlier.
And that was an interesting thing.
We've all got our field teams.
Yes.
You can't have eyes on every, even, so that makes me feel so much better. You can't have eyes on everything. So I have a multitude of friends and we all talk about music and there's the pipeline, right?
Yeah. Electric Chorus one is interesting because I believe that was, they were looking at August for this year, and that's kind of another example of kind of August seeming to be kind of the bubble for some of these festivals in terms of like, a lot of them I think don't feel comfortable with it, but I don't have the names like right on hand, but there are some like kind of smaller niche boutique type festivals happening then, but you aren't really seeing the major ones that are going to be bringing, you know, tens of thousands of people necessarily. So I mean, that's interesting for sure, you know, kind of, yeah, as we look at the late summer, early fall seems to really kind of be where things
fall. Maybe because it was an August one, they're like, we can't push this to September. September is jam-packed now, just from an economic standpoint. They're like, we need to just kick it all. There could just be that type of decision.
I mean, there's a serious issue with all these. I wrote a story about this and talked to some folks kind of regarding the super crowded calendar in September and October as it pertains to talent, just because it's like, you know, okay, like normally you don't have, you know, Bonnaroo in September. Normally you don't have, all these kind of festivals descending on top of the ones that normally are there on the calendar. And, you know, it's hard. You can't beat replacements at once if you're an artist.
Right. I mean, there's this crazy confluence of a ton of festivals and then touring kind of trying to start back up in some way.
And it's interesting because I talked to a agent who represents both Tyler the Creator and Lizzo, who are both playing Outside Lands at the end of October. And I also spoke to somebody from Another Planet, which promotes Outside Lands. And and they were both saying that, like, yeah, actually, there was a wild card of like whether or not Lizzo and Tyler the Creator would end up playing Outside Lands. They'd been on the originally announced August 2021 lineup. Would they be able to carry over to the Halloween dates? And what actually ended up happening, as I've heard it's happening with a lot of artists, is that they just are saying, we're just going to do the festival plays. We're not going to mess around with touring. Just going to do the festival plays. And like that way they don't have to, you know, basically pull out of festivals. And then they can kind of look at, you know, maybe we'll get back out on the road for our own tours in 2022.
Yeah. On the other hand, I've heard, I've talked to some booking agents and some major, you know, agencies and, Marshall Betts that I had, on the show, and that he's like, you know, as you know, their tours are booked right now. Right. Yeah. They're just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean,
the interesting thing about the touring is just regarding, we were talking before about like taking your lead from the CDC and stuff. Kind of one thing that's made this whole period challenging really is the fact that for these national touring artists, they're having to look at, okay, you know, municipalities, states, federal, like what are the restrictions? Because they can vary, and sometimes there are odds with each other.
Right?
Odds
with
the CDC. And you know, if you're a touring artist, especially, you know, one who maybe isn't a arena headliner with that sort of funds, but if you're, you know, kind of your average, you know, indie rock artist or something who plays clubs and stuff, if you suddenly have, you know, like if you're on tour and you're coming up on California, and suddenly California comes offline, that's like a huge blow to your routing and to kind of making the tour financially viable. So a lot of these, you know, agents and artists, they don't necessarily want to get back out on the road until they know, okay, we can do the whole tour in all these different places.
Right. Right. Yeah. Gosh. Do you ever think, I know probably like your job is to report on all this stuff, but is this a positive or a negative for you personally? I mean, did you think, like, when you think back on this, are you like, wow, this is crazy? I'm reporting on live music, which is not even happening. I mean, but that's a story in itself. I mean, what sort of, like, from an existential journalistic perspective, sort of how are you seeing what you're doing right now in the in the timeline of reporting?
Well, you know, when I was at Entertainment Weekly, I really did not interface with anybody except for, like, you know, the publicist is up interviewing them, the artists in the interview. I wasn't really digging into the industry side of things, and I had always kind of been interested in that. So I came to Polestar, yeah, and suddenly, you know, interviewing agents and managers, promoters, venue people, etc. And it was still kind of, you know, there's a rhythm to it, and these stories have a certain rhythm, and, you know, you're writing about such and such artists going on their arena tour, and there'll be, like, interesting little things about, like, you know, whatever, like, what lighting company are they working with? Who's the creative director and stuff, but nothing, like, we're in the middle of this, like, big story that's unfolding necessarily, you know, it's just kind of reporting about this hugely successful industry that people love.
So
then suddenly it's like COVID happens.
It's all about happy stuff. It's all boring.
It's all happy stuff. Yeah. And suddenly you hit this and everybody's like, whoa, I don't want to talk to you. Like, like, this is like the, you know, you're talking to some of these people. You know, I actually was working on a story, funny enough, about First Avenue when COVID happened. I was working on a story for Venues Now, where I also write for. I was working on a story for them for the anniversary of First Avenue. And so I was, you know, in the process of talking to setting up interviews and talking to some of these people, including Dana Frank, yep, who would later go on to, you know, be the head of Neva and everything. Uh-huh. And, like, they went dark for, like, a couple of days, and then it's like, oh, hey, Eric, like, I'm really sorry, but, like, this has been, like, kind of a crazy time for us, you know? Right.
I just got out of bed after 2 days and wasn't checking my email.
Yeah, yeah, it was just a crazy time, and, yeah, I mean, you know, it's been interesting kind of talking to people, because at the same time, you've seen something that's been interesting in the reporting, that you have seen, like, a lot of camaraderie. Like, I talked to the 210s from the Hideout, and they were, you know, kind of talking about, like, there is this, like, you know, sense of camaraderie in terms of, like, this industry that is always, like, very competitive and, like, you know, people competing for, like, bookings and stuff, and suddenly it's like everybody's just kind of like, okay, how are we going to get through this, and, like, I'll help you. You know, I'll help you navigate, like, the loan portal and stuff to get relief and whatnot. Yeah. So yeah, it's been kind of interesting and, you know, encouraging in that way to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it's some pretty juicy reporting for sure, right? I mean, yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of different perspectives, and there's a lot of, like, camaraderie, like you said. I mean, the more that everyone sort of intersects, the more interesting it gets, right? I mean, yeah, it's not just kind of like, we're getting this artist and you're not. So it's more about how are we all going to come out of this on the other end. So
it's like, I would love to be arguing with you in a year or two about, you know, getting that booking. I would love to be,
let's focus on that. You know? Right. Right. Yeah. So you also write for Venues Now. And so I want to talk about Venues, but how does that, what publication is that?
Yeah.
So explain a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah. So Polestar, is owned by the same parent company as Venues Now, Oakview mm-hmm. Group. And Venues Now is the trade magazine for venues. So we, you know, report about everything you would ever want to know about venues, we report about. This month in our issue, we have a giant feature about seating and seating companies that handle the seats. And, you know, I've reported about, you know, ticketing and concessions and, you know, ingress, egress and that type of thing. Just kind of looking at...
Oh, interesting. I find it so fascinating. Obviously, I have a whole podcast based on live music experience. So,
yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting thing because, you know, one thing that we have seen over the course of the pandemic regarding venues is that a lot of venues have used this time to make improvements that you normally wouldn't, you know, the metaphor I've heard is, you know, like fixing the plane while it's in the air type stuff. Like you know, now that things are grounded, you can, you know, do these type of projects that you can't do, you know, when you're having shows every night. And so I think,
yeah, all those things that need money, by the way, but that's the story too.
Yeah. I mean, but it's interesting though. And I think that, you know, people who are coming back to venues of all sizes are going to see, you know, all sorts of new things. Then these venues are not
new
necessarily
new bathrooms. That would be great.
New bathrooms, you know. But just in terms of you know, we were really following things like contactless concessions and mobile ticketing. We were following those before the pandemic, and this is only going to have accelerated them. Just kind of the idea of you're in a venue and the points of contact are kind of reduced, which obviously has its has its advantages with regard to the pandemic, but also it's just, you know, more convenient for consumers, you know, ordering on your phone, all that type of thing.
And how many are you seeing? A ton of venues that have just been bought up by AXS, for example, or Live Nation. Like I bought tickets for Dawes at the Vic in December, right? And it's an AXS venue now, or at least AXS is selling the tickets for them, which I assume also means that they own that venue. So I didn't know that. And that kind of came as a shock. We're going to see a lot of that going forward, right?
Yeah, well, we've seen, you know, being in New York, we saw a couple of years ago, the Bowery Presents got bought up by AEG. And there's kind of been like, you know, seeing that, you know, we're AEG town now, in terms of they handle a lot of these venues, a lot of these clubs. And yeah, I mean, that another thing that we were tracking going into COVID was kind of the club, what's going on in club land, and Live Nation was buying up a lot of things. You know, I'm not sure how that plays out. I do seem to kind of remember some things said by Live Nation on a recent earning call, kind of regarding maybe not being so hot on the club sector anymore. I think that the hardship, those clubs run such tight margins, even if they are kind of owned by the mothership of one of these bigger, you know, companies, that the pandemic has been
the margins are so small.
The pandemic has been a learning experience for them that, you know, these
we don't want to be in that.
So, you know, the amphitheaters and the arenas are such big money makers for them.
And they have the infrastructure to handle that. I was talking to Jim DeRogatis and Greg Codd on this show, that with Sound Opinions.
Love them.
And I love them too. And he's making the same point about how the independent venues are such small margins, and Live Nation has, it's kind of a duality, right? Live Nation has an interest in having smaller venues bring artists up that'll eventually be performing in larger venues, right?
Yeah.
But so they have an interest in the that businesses of independent venues stay healthy so that they continue to have, it's sort of like the farm teams. They have these feeder teams, right? The places where, you know, smaller acts can eventually, you know, get to become bigger acts. They just don't want to deal with that from an economic standpoint. And it just adds all this stuff to their balance sheet and all these expenses and operating expenses, et cetera. So
yeah,
there is kind of, it's a twofold kind of story there.
Yeah.
And some independent venues obviously just folded, right? I mean, that's kind of the sadder story. I'd rather go to a show at a venue than for that venue not to be there any longer.
Yeah, it's been a huge bummer seeing some of these venues, you know, struggle and you know, some really special places go out of business. You know, it's what can you even say? I mean, it's been really, you know, devastating. I think that's kind of, you know, the artists can get back out on the road, but some of these venues, you know, they don't get to just start back up. So that's been really hard for us to watch. And, you know, if you want to talk about tough reporting, it's tough talking to some of these people, you know, saying, you know, I've exhausted all my lines of credit. I've dipped into my personal savings to keep this place open. You know, it's catastrophic what's happened. And, you know, seeing kind of the poor implementation, I'll say, of some of this, you know, save our stages funding for, So to kind of bring folks up to speed, like basically, NIVA, the National Independent Venue Association, fought for, the entirety of 2020, basically to secure relief, which was secured. The Save Our Stages Act was what they had fought for. $15 billion of relief for independent venues was included in that huge omnibus package that Trump signed right before he left office. And then it kind of just stalled. Like the funds were earmarked, but they were to be administered by the Small Business Administration, and they were supposed to, you know, open up the applications by mid-February. That came and went, and then, you know, finally at the beginning of this month, I think like April 7th or something, they finally opened up the applications, to independent venue operators, and within like hours or something, the site had some glitch and they had to take it down. It's been down ever since. So, I think that
so no one's getting any money off of Save Our Stages.
No, not only is nobody getting any money, nobody's even like able to apply to get money, because there still is this, you know, there's kind of these issues of, you know, where this is another kind of story we've been tracking. It's like some of these independent venues predominantly book Live Nation artists, Live Nation tours, because Live Nation is such a dominant force in kind of the national touring industry. And so kind of based on some of the initial stipulations, at least in the Small Business Association had for this, these funds and how they were administered, there were some things where like venues that were independent but booked Live Nation tours were getting lumped in as like Live Nation, because Live Nation isn't eligible for these funds, and you know, those venue operators were like, whoa, wait a sec, I just booked the Live Nation tours to, you know, have good business and stuff, right? Like, I'm still independent though, you know. And so that's been kind of a fascinating thing to track as well.
Yeah, really disappointing thing to track. I mean, God, that's really crazy, man. I had no idea that it was like just the landscape out there looks so bad.
Yeah, so you know, this is, you know, kind of not be kind of a NEVA spokesperson here for a second, that, you know, like write your congressman or whatever and tell him to make sure the SBA. There has been some interesting things, you know, from senators and congresspeople on both sides of the aisle, kind of putting the pressure on the SBA. I know that it took a while for Biden's nominee to head the administration to like get in there, and I think that might have been why. There was some delay. It took a couple months after he took office, actually, for that person to kind of assume control. So,
right. Yeah. Not the most ideal of scenarios when there's an administration transition, right? So that added on top of everything else.
Wow.
That's sobering.
So we're still waiting to see exactly what that aid looks like. There was, I believe, like another $1.2 billion added to the initial figure in the like Biden stimulus that he did in like, I guess, late February, early March or whatever. So we have a little bit more funding, but it still would be good to actually get.
Yeah, well, let's
hope
that comes through, because I know that a lot of venue owners, as you know, are waiting for that and plan to pay a lot of their employees like back wages. Or, I mean, I know I've talked to a couple different venue owners that are looking to do that and hoping to do that.
Yeah, so there was also a weird loophole in the initial legislation that Biden's stimulus also fixed, where there wasn't. You weren't going to be able to apply for a second round of the PPP, Payroll Protection Program funding, and one of these small venue operator grants, they're called, that are stipulated by the, by the Save Our Stages Act. And so they removed that issue. So now you can get both channels of funding.
Interesting. So. Wow. Well, and we haven't even talked about streaming, really. I mean, that's kind of like this whole other world of live music now, right? Yeah. Is that's in your category too, right?
Yeah. So that was kind of, to the extent that I had a beat over the last year, that was one of kind of my main beats that I was reporting on, both, you know, pre-existing streaming companies and,
fortunately.
And, you know, pre-existing streaming companies and new ones, and kind of seeing, you know, how both, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, you had these artists just kind of going gorilla from their couch, and the sound, you know, we were talking about like sound quality for this podcast interview and stuff. You know, some of the artists were coming with like the same kind of, well, just plug in my iPhone or whatever. And it doesn't exactly work. And so of how some of these,
well, let's be clear. You weren't really criticizing me about my own audio though. Right?
I'm criticizing myself for not having a fancy microphone. it's been definitely fascinating.
The expectations on my audio are higher, hopefully.
Yes. It's been interesting for sure. Just in terms of, as a big jam band guy, somebody who loves the Dead and stuff, the concept of couch tour has been familiar to me for several years, just kind of in terms of, you know, Dead & Co is on tour. They sell these packages where you can tune in every night and see the show from your couch. A lot of people actually, you know, sometimes will be like, I don't even like going to concerts. I hate like being there. I'll just watch it from my couch. And, you know, so this technology and this model existed, but we hadn't really seen it kind of blown up to, you know, you're never going to, you know, I don't know, see like a, you know, Waxahachie live stream necessarily before COVID. And, you know, she did some really cool live streaming. And so it's interesting to see that monetized as, you know, after the first few weeks, yeah, people started saying, okay, we got to make some money here. You know, we got to sell some tickets here. So that's been interesting. You know,
I mean, 11/11 has done amazing, right?
11/11. Yep. Yeah. I wrote a cover story about them. They're kind of another jam band hub management company, and their artists really seized the day early on in terms of not only streaming, but monetizing that streaming. You had, Goose, Pigeons Playing Ping Pong, Twiddle, and, you know, they had some also, you know, really interesting kind of innovative ideas, because something that we saw with live streaming is like, okay, how can we make this not be, not just be a camera filming somebody? What can we do to mix this up? How can we make this interactive?
Goose Bingo Tour, man.
Goose Bingo Tour, yeah. How can we make this interactive? And, you know, I think kind of the gold standard for me of that I saw, I see Animal in your background.
Animal, yeah, that's my dog.
Yeah, so cute.
He likes to sleep on his back on the cool tiles near the fireplace.
Oh, that's so sweet. What's his name?
That's Sammy.
Ooh.
Yes, I'm talking about you, dude. He just kind of looked over here.
Yeah. In terms of the gold standard of live streaming, I think I've seen has been Trey Anastasio's Beacon Jams that he did.
Those were amazing. That was amazing.
eight week residency once a week from the Beacon Theater, where you're tying together kind of a bunch of the strands that we've seen in streaming as kind of the initial shock of the pandemic kind of, you know, receded, in terms of you've got an artist who is going to a venue rather than doing it from, you know, their home. They're figuring out a way to take full production and to even, like, you know, modify and amplify it for this format, where Trey was playing with the seats of the audience behind him rather than playing to them.
I loved that too. So I first really saw that with Phoebe Bridgers doing that from Red Rocks.
Yeah,
and it was probably, maybe that was just something else that was being done somewhere else. Yeah. I don't know. But the first time I noticed that, there she's up in the crowd in their film. She's up in the stands, like near the soundboard. They put the stage, which was great.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's what you want to see, right? Like something unique. And then Trey was doing it too. And
so
I don't
Trey,
know, I guess,
those were through Twitch.
That was amazing.
Those were through Twitch, which was interesting because he had this live chat going on, which, you know, when you're a smaller artist, you're kind of sitting there monitoring yourself. He had his daughter in like a team monitoring this flurry, you know, this torrent of comments coming in from people watching, and they would pass things through to his monitor, and the shows were to benefit his new addiction treatment facility that he's starting in Vermont. And he would be, you know, engaging with these fans, and they'd be, you know, some of them would be writing in like funny fish trivia, and others would be, you know, sharing these stories of, you know, of people in their lives who, you know, succumbed to addiction and died or went through these hardships. And Trey, you know, who's a recovering addict himself, would, you know, kind of go on these discussions with them. It was very sobering and felt very intimate. And I talked to him for a cover story about those shows, and he was saying, you know, maybe there's a way to integrate like chat on a monitor on stage with like when we come back to shows. And that's kind of interesting to think about, like, how will live streaming exactly impact live shows when we come back? You know, whether it's kind of like integrating interactivity, whether it's streaming out to people who, you know, either, you know, can't afford shows or can't access them because, you know, disability reasons or because of where they live, you know, allowing those people to access them, you know. And also we're looking at some of these cases of, there's another company I've been looking at in live streaming called Mandolin that's done some really cool paid live streaming content that has really cool like merchant integration and stuff. And one of the things that they've been doing is that you can actually take the data of seeing, okay, like, you know, for such and such artists doing a live stream, a paid live stream, where are these people who are buying the live stream tickets? And then you can use that to inform, okay, well, like, maybe they randomly have like a huge fan contingent, like Salt Lake City or something. So we'll play a slightly bigger venue there than they're doing on the rest of their tour routing. And that we have the numbers.
Yeah. Without having to go to Salt Lake City and like have no one show up or have like more people show up and sell out the show, which is a good scenario. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to use that kind of data. Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting if live streaming ends up benefiting either, you know, benefiting artists or kind of, you know, making the fan artist connection, you know, change in some way.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of the people that I have on the show. I had Andrew Jensen on of Noon Chorus, who was right, one of your neighbors out there in Brooklyn. The Audio Tree people are coming up as a guest on the show. And the integration of live streaming is going to be interesting. I don't particularly see a performer reading chat when there's an audience in the room. But where would you stand on that?
Well, I still see that kind of really happening. The interesting thing that Trey said is that, like, the example he gave was...
I mean, don't get me wrong, it totally worked when Trey was there, and that's an amazing example, and he was so great at it, and he just has a way with talking in such a... he's so affable and personable that really did work, and
the example that he gave was when they're on stage at the Garden... When Fish is on stage at the Garden and there's a huge, you know, it's sold out, there's whatever, 20,000 people in there, he can't have a dialogue with the person in the front row, you know, like you can't have that dialogue necessarily at an arena show. So doing something virtually or via text could be the only way to actually have that sort of a dialogue with somebody in the audience. And so, you know, it's like, what if there was a way, could this potentially indicate a way that could happen? You know, I'm skeptical how that would look in a live show, but you know, a lot of things are going to look different when we come back to shows after COVID.
Well, yeah, I mean, and Trey's not, like you said, I mean, obviously he's not, it was very evident, he's not reading the text that just rolls by really fast on Twitch. You know, his daughter, whomever, his team was like picking out the good ones, which might be interesting. I mean, and people could be in a crowd in the Garden actually on Twitch asking questions as well, right?
Well, and so, you know, that's
there is a next level of interactivity
that's an interesting thing, you know, to think about too, is kind of comparing something like that on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, a couple of years ago, I went to a Raconteur show, and you had to put your phone in the yonder pouch. So, like, you know, there's a bit of a spectrum here of, like, are you trying to actually have people on their phones more at the show because of technology that's been developed now?
Right,
or are you
trying to have people
put them away? Like, you know.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that was one example of just how that might occur. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. No, it's about connecting with those that are at home. But I think what you were mentioning, the Salt Lake City example, it's really interesting for smaller level bands to be able to provide their music to others. I mean, what KEXP's already been doing, what Audio Tree's already been doing, and then you build that into venues. What are you hearing about venues that are now fitting into their own venues, permanent cameras for high def streaming?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting, and it's a way of kind of doing an additive revenue stream, especially as some of these, you know, venues and artists kind of look to recoup more than a year of lost revenue. You know, if you have a, you know, thinking about Chicago, Lincoln Hall, one of my favorite haunts, you know, like if you have a sold out show there, only holds whatever, like 500 people, you know, and you're able to sell then live streams on top of that, that could be, you know, hugely valuable. And there were a lot of venues even before COVID that, like, through Nugs, had several affiliate venues all throughout the country that had you know, hardwired rigs in there, so that, you know, some of these venues that, you know, host kind of some of the more jam-oriented artists on that circuit would be able to do that. But yeah, you are hearing more and more about venues installing that equipment first, you know, partly because some of them just put it in for live streams from their venues during COVID, and they're just going to keep it there.
Yeah, but why strip it out now? And even if you sold extra tickets for $5, it's still added revenue, right? Yep.
And, you know, another thing that can't be understated or underrated is, like, kind of the idea of this technology is much cheaper now than it used to be. You know, the idea 10 years ago of putting in, like, that sort of a video rig into your, you know, not only would it not have been as good, but it was just so expensive, and now it's, you know, more affordable, more reasonably priced.
Right. It's interesting. So how does your own personal musical taste figure into what your role is as in following live music?
Yeah.
Because I know you like the Grateful Dead. I mean, we already talked about that. They're, you know, I used to follow them a little bit. I mean, not like on the road, but they're really kind of an example of me from way back, the way that I want to see music. I want to see a different song. I'd like to go to a tour and never see the same song once, but I mean, never see the same, never see a repeat of a song. Right. Okay, you got me.
Who knows what these guys are going to play?
Right, yeah, no. See, new songs that you've never seen before. Yeah. But yeah, you know what I mean. I mean, the different set lists. And, but apart from that, like, how does your own personal musical interest figure into what you do as a journalist?
I don't know. It's interesting. When I was at Entertainment Weekly, I kind of learned a lot about, we had a very small music team and I covered a very wide range of things. So like I have my things that I enjoy and stuff, but I was definitely kind of I interviewed everybody from Migos to Shania Twain to Brian Eno when I was there. And like, you know, I kind of knew I consider myself as a music fan. I like to dabble. I'm interested in all sorts of stuff. I will go to any concert and see, you know, whatever, you know, I don't know how much I'll like it necessarily, but I'm very interested in, you know, all sorts of stuff. You know, I definitely love jam band stuff. And in the couple of years before the pandemic, I was getting really into kind of going to a lot of, a lot of kind of like late night electronic shows. We'd have like a lot of, you know, these lineups that go till 4 a.m. and a lot of different DJs and stuff. And, you know, I kind of find that interesting, that scene and also the jam band scene, just, you know, kind of getting a little bit more into these kind of more, you know, passionate sub communities where it feels like there's a little bit more going on there sometimes than some of the, you know, I obviously have been to many an indie rock show. That's like my home base in terms of my home genre, you know, but sometimes those shows can get a little bit like, okay, like I'm just here for like, see my band do their hour long set. Everybody's going to stand like totally sit still and you can hear a pin drop and then everybody's going to leave. And it's just going to be kind of,
well, that's still a sub. That's still like a sub genre. That's what I find very interesting about, like, I have a wide variety of musical tastes, and that's, from a live music perspective, it's so interesting to see all the different groups of fans and how that develops and the subgenres and the different kinds of cultural and anthropological differences between groups of fans at a show. I find super interesting. Yeah. That's one of the most fascinating things about music.
Yeah, you know,
and just the wide variety of tastes that are just out there is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, like coming off of COVID, I'm looking for more of like these kind of like, you know, I'm looking for like, I want to go to the jam band shows and like do the jam band thing. I want to go to the electronic shows and like do the kind of electronic show thing. And I want to go to like the, like, you know, punk show and there's like a pit and like people are into it. Like, I'm like very interested in kind of going to some of these. I mean, not that I didn't before, but that's how I'm most interested and excited about coming back.
Yeah.
Like some whatever jazz guy honking on his sax wherever, you know.
So you're looking forward to the going back to sort of different kinds of genres
and like kind of more like specialty stuff. I'm very interested in, you know, kind of some of these more niche things. And yeah, I don't know.
You always have been, or you think that sort of like just bringing the absence of shows has kind of like brought that more to the fore for you?
I always have been interested in all that sort of stuff, but definitely, you know, coming out of COVID, that's what I'm most excited for, just in terms of, you know, oh, what show am I most excited to go see? Maybe less to go see. I don't want to like, you know, put anybody on blast or whatever, but.
No, I mean, come on. You know, it's like I'm interested in your musical taste because you're a deadhead. You're well, and you rolled your eyes at that term.
No. I didn't roll my eyes. I didn't mean to.
I love the Grateful Dead, but I'm not a deadhead. Let's say that. I mean, I never toured with them. I had the good fortune to have lived in New York City from 88 to 99. So that encompassed a good 8 years of the Dead coming and doing long ass runs at Madison Square Garden, 9-night runs, 3 nights a day off, 3 nights a day off, 3 nights. So did I see all of them? No, I couldn't afford it. I was in grad school at the time, but I did. I saw a number of their shows. But what I like about your background and where you come from, and what I identify with, is that you love jam bands, but you're also kind of at home in indie rock. Mm-hmm. And there's very few people like us out there, I have to say.
Well, definitely, jam is something that I came to later. Like, or I was really into the Dead. So, like, you know, in middle school and high school, I loved American Beauty, obviously. I think that anybody kind of who's like a classic rock person usually will love that album. And I never really envisioned myself getting into them. I got really into the Dead in college, and then, you know, kind of expanded out through jam just over the last couple of years, actually. So I was like, you know, a few years ago, I would do, you know, there's some Deadheads, and I fell into this category of people who'd be like, well, the Dead are kind of like, I'm not really a jam band fan. I'm like a Grateful Dead fan. And like, there's kind of difference, you know, the Dead bring in all this other yada yada. And like, I would kind of do that thing sometimes too. Like, indie rock definitely was and still is probably my home base as far as these things go.
Well, the Dead brings in so many other elements of Americana, and they're, you know, they came from, they're hippies, man. They're like 1960s people, essentially, right? but I think what you're speaking to is that divergence of when Phish came online, and then there were jam bands that sort of went in the Phish direction, and there are others that have stayed in the Dead realm, and that's sort of a new direction of where everything's going.
Well, yeah, so. I would recoil because, you know, people say, oh, you're a jam band fan. Oh, that must mean that you're into, you know, whatever. And, you know, no disrespect to any of these bands, but they would, you know, it implies you're into, you know, Widespread and String Cheese and, you know, all these other artists, Disco Biscuits, and kind of just like, it's like, no, like I'm still definitely, you know, I'm still like, my last show before the pandemic was Destroyer, you know, that's kind of still where I'm coming from in terms
I saw that run.
Yeah. And in terms of the stuff that I'm into, you know, I'm definitely.
Yeah. Are you a fan of The National?
You know, The National is interesting because I've never really fully connected with them in terms
of huge Deadheads, all of those guys except for Matt.
Oh God. I piss my National friends off because I say my favorite National thing is the Day of the Dead comp, and that really gets under their skin. But the National is never a band that I've like, I totally like it when I put on their records. It's not a band that I've like ever like really connected with in that like deeper, oh my God, I love this band so much type of way. But a couple of years ago, I saw them do an underplay at Irving Plaza. They were in town, I think for some, I forget what for, but or why they were doing it, but they did this underplay there and just blew me away. I mean, one of the greatest like live acts that I've seen. And I saw them a couple of years ago doing amazing, they were headlining and Courtney Barnett was opening outdoors in Prospect Park. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing, amazing show. And that one was awesome.
I saw it. Like, I saw a ton of shows. That was like 2019. I saw like 12 shows on that tour. They came through the Midwest and did a whole bunch. I just talked to Kate Stables, who was a backing vocalist on that tour for a ton of those different shows. So that was like a super interesting kind of inside look into the National. You know, she's with This Is the Kit, which you may not be familiar with. Are you familiar with that band? Yeah, they're phenomenal.
Well, another thing I say that irks National fans is that I think my favorite National albums are like the last three National albums. The one like Trouble Will Find.
Why would that irk anybody? They're amazing.
I don't know. People get like, oh, like what about Alligator and Boxer and stuff? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Like the most recent stuff, they've been in this like really good groove. It feels like a lot more like kind of textural to me almost, like just kind of.
Oh, they're beautiful albums. Sleep Well Beast, right there, man. It's an amazing album, and I'm easy to find. I love them, and they'll also cover The Dead, too. When I saw them in Denver, they did Peggy O.
Same, when I saw them in New York. Yeah. Awesome.
One of my most regrettable concert misses when I was on the East Coast, and it was for a good reason because I stayed in Providence when my daughter was going to school there and stayed to have dinner with her that day, but I was going to see them after. Subsequent in 2018, they played two nights at Forest Hills. Mm-hmm. But the night before, they played at the Post Pavilion in Maryland, and they did Morning Dew there. Amazing. And I just chose not to go to that show. But so that was like, you know, you always have that one show that you missed that you're like, oh, damn.
One of my kind of bucket list, or I don't know, not bucket list, but the National. I got offered a free ticket when I was in high school to see, it was REM's later to be found out their final tour, and with Modest Mouse opening and the National opening, it was 08. And I had to like study for a test, and I was just like too nervous, and I was like, I can't go. Sorry, I'm a nerd, and I didn't, and I forever regret it. It's a free ticket.
Well, you got a good education. You got a good education. You weren't blowing away. You weren't blowing off schoolwork. I mean, there's a level of respectability in that kind of decision. So,
but then other
that's something you tell your kids later on. You know that you're like, look, you know, don't blow off schoolwork to go to shows.
Actually, another interesting national thing that build I saw them with Courtney Barnett. It was, you know, whatever June evening in New York, big thunderstorm rolled in like a third of the way through the national set, and just torrential rain, and like nobody left. It was like amazing. Like a lot of the time, a situation like that, you know, a lot of kind of flighty fair weather fans would just be like literally fair weather fans would just be like, I'm getting out of here, it's raining.
Right.
Everybody, no, I mean, no, not talk national about a passionate fans. Fan base. They were there.
I love it, man. I love it. Yeah, talk about different fan bases. I mean, I'm a My Morning Jacket fan, I'm a Jam Band fan, I'm a National fan, among other things. But being in and moving around in those different kinds of fan bases and meeting all these people with all kinds of different musical tastes, it's always incredibly fascinating to me, as is the live music industry. So
you just mentioned Forest Hills, and I saw My Morning Jacket there a couple of years ago, 2019, when they were doing those two. They did like a
I
didn't see the one at the cap.
That poster is from 2017.
Okay.
But yeah, 2019, that was the last show they've done.
They were doing like that, two and two or something at like Red Rocks.
They did two at Red Rocks. I went to both of those. And then they played one up at the cap where they played Tennessee Fire, mm-hmm. which was their first album.
Mm-hmm. But I saw the one at Forest Hills.
And then
Hills,
the next night they played at Forest Hills.
Amazing.
Yeah. Did you like, had you seen them before?
I saw them in 2010 at Outside Land. Which was great. And that was, you know, kind of a very, I remember Jim had like this towel around his head, and it was like a foggy late afternoon in Golden Gate Park, rolling in over the trees. It all felt very like mystical, and they did Gideon, and I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. But they were great.
I love them so much.
They're great at Forest Hills, and like the waterfall material just like pops live. Like I like that album. I never really like done the dive on it, and just like live, I was just like, "Holy cow, this is amazing!" Like and the old stuff, of course, obviously. But yeah, I mean, talk about just a great band and great live band.
Well, my favorite. So, yeah, I love them. I can't say enough about them. I'm floored by them. I got a good surprise in the show coming up, which I'm not sure when we're going to publish this, but we're going to have a My Morning Jacket oriented individual. So I'm really psyched that I've already done it. So I'm really psyched about it. And
awesome.
That's one of the, I mean, pretty well recognized as one of the best live rock acts out there. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's been on my. I went to Bonnaroo once in 2016. They weren't there that year, but it's been on my kind of my bucket list item is My Morning Jacket at Bonnaroo. That's definitely something I want to do.
Yeah, me too. But two things you were talking about you've never seen Phish, and like that's kind of like one of your quarantine kind of revelations. said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same with me. Actually, I'm as many people that have seen The Dead many times and have kind of moved into that or sort of in that area. I'm just one of those people that hasn't seen Phish yet, but I feel like there were so many great opportunities to see older shows, and I've just started to just listen to their music a whole lot more, and I really love them.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
I'm looking forward to, there's always bands that you know, got to start sometime.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Phish, that was an interesting one. I kind of, you know, took a quarantine, no live shows to do it, but I did get into them and, you know, really took the dive. And that's been one of the more rewarding things for me over the last year is kind of getting to know their music and getting to know kind of what's going on with them. And yeah, I can't wait to see them. I actually did see part of a Phish show at Outside Lands one year when they were headlining, we did not stick around. We wanted to go get front row or very good positioning for the Shins. We're playing opposite them.
Oh,
and so
cool.
We went and saw them, and a little bit disappointed in retrospect because the mix was very, it's one of my, definitely, they were fine. The Shins were fine, but whoever was whoever was doing the audio at that show was something was up. Like we joked that it sounded like dubstep new slang. Like the bass was so loud.
Seriously, I mean, even being close on that for that show, you felt like the mix wasn't good, because usually, you know, if you're like close enough, it doesn't really matter what the PA mix is.
Right? Yeah, I don't know what was up that day, or if we were like in some weird dead zone in the. You know,
it was the fog again.
It was the fog, yeah.
So you like Outside Lands, huh?
Yeah, I haven't been in a long time. I went to the first night of the first one when Radiohead played. Beck was like on before them. That was amazing. I've seen some great shows there over the years. I mean, seeing Arcade Fire headline there in 2011, last show of the weekend, really when they were at the height of their powers as far as, you know, their whole thing went. And that was just transcendent. It was amazing, you know.
And some
interesting things, in 2012 I went and I saw Foo Fighters and Jack White there, but neither of them were their day's headliners, which was interesting. Foo Fighters was on the main stage second to last act before Neil Young, and Jack White was on the main stage second to last act before Stevie Wonder. So like, obviously, you know, bigger artists than them, but still, still headliners in their own right. But it was funny. It was funny because Dave Grohl during the Foo Fighters set, he kept saying, "Hey guys, sorry if I'm playing all these songs really fast, but I just want to get this over with and go get ready to see Neil fucking Young." And he was like a little kid out there. Just like, so he like couldn't get, really have cared less about the Foo Fighters set. He just wanted to see Neil.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, your headline, your intro to that anecdote was made sense, right? That they weren't even the headliners.
Yeah.
But then you mentioned who the headliners were, and they're like, "Oh yeah, of course not."
Yeah. No, that was a very stacked year to go to Outside Lands, I would say, because like you literally got like a couple headliner level caliber people, and then people who were even more headliner caliber than them.
And Foo Fighters weren't on the same stage.
No. Well, yeah. So Foo Fighters was on the same stage as Neil, the act before him. Yeah, so it's interesting.
Oh, so what did? Oh, it's, oh, because so you wanted to play fast to get his set over with, so that he could hang and watch Neil.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was like even funnier that like he would have to race to the other end to see like Neil at a different stage.
I know Stevie was up against Skrillex, was the one opposite stage, the other main stage from him. I forget opposite Neil. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, there was one year at Lala. I'd already seen the National like four times that week, and they're playing at Lala, and I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to deal with all the crowds. You know, I've already seen them a whole bunch of times. But then Bruno Mars was playing all the way at the other end, and the people that I know that went to see the National at Lala said that, oh, it was the best show to go to because everybody just emptied out the National stage at that point and just went to Bruno Mars, and it was just a perfect.
Oh, isn't that funny? Like, yeah, I'm one of the biggest. I'm a huge, huge St. Vincent fan, and in 2015, I was at Gov Ball, and she was playing opposite who was on the other stage, Florence and the Machine, and everyone was at Florence, and so I just like walked right up to the St. Vincent. I was like the third row, just like walking up, like, you know, nobody was there.
I think that's what I got the sense that's what it's like for this one. Yeah,
similar. I forget who she was up against, but like I did the same scene, Bjork. Like nobody who was at Governor's Ball, everybody's young, nobody cares about Bjork, and I just like walked right up and it was just like, yeah, nobody was there.
So did you like St. Vince's performance on SNL?
It's definitely interesting to see the new direction that she's going in.
It's interesting.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I kind of think that she can do no wrong. I'm very generous with my praise of her. I do like definitely still think of her like 2014 self-titled album when she was really in the like art rock phase as being like kind of her apex, but I'll stand the, mass seduction synth poppy stuff, and I think that this new material she's got, you know, it's kind of interesting and fun, and I'm excited to, you know, see where she takes it. I like that she kind of has this more like organic, almost like Steely Dan-ified sound.
I love the performances. I love how she staged them. I love what she was doing, getting up there and just sitting in a chair. Like, okay, that's different and cool. I mean, she takes so many cues from David Byrne, I kind of feel.
Yeah.
in that sort of like, I'm a performance artist, but I can also rock, and she can rock the shit out of a guitar too. I saw the Mass Seduction tour at Chicago Theater. That was fucking amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that was
I was kind of blown away by her music, by her guitar playing.
Tour. You know, that one was interesting because that definitely felt like very informed by like almost like a stop making, you were talking about David Byrne. It felt very informed by like kind of a stop making sense, like visual.
The SNL performance?
The Mass Seduction tour felt like, it's very like, you know, visual performance art aspect. I did on that tour. I missed her really rock band phase where she had this like killer rock band. And that was just amazing from like, I'd seen her at Pitchfork in 2014. And that was one of the best festival sets I've ever seen. She was just out of control. Awesome. And then I saw her again at BAM in 2018, where she did it was just her and a piano player, and they did a bunch of piano versions of her songs, and she covered Lou Reed's Perfect Day, which was amazing.
Right.
So, you know, she's the real deal. She's so talented.
Where are you with War on Drugs?
They're great. Yeah.
I was kind of like feeling like you'd like them. I just sort of wanted to confirm.
You know,
that. I fucking love them. One of the greatest 1 hour sets, short sets I've seen was the War on Drugs at Pitchfork a couple of years ago.
I've never seen them.
Just scintillating and gripping from just the get go.
Yeah.
Like I was blown. I turned around. That was an hour of just absolute crushing set.
Yeah. I mean, I love, my favorite one is their most recent one, A Deeper Understanding. I think that album is great. Mm-hmm. And something that always sticks with me is something that Mark Richardson wrote in his Pitchfork review of the album, kind of talking about how the drums are almost like a little bit like krautrock influenced versus like kind of the more reverb-y drum sound that you would think of with like, you know, whatever, like kind of some of the more 80s rock, heartland rock that they're often compared to. And like, that's always stuck with me. And it's just... Yeah, talk about like awesome, like windows down driving music. I hope to see them live sooner rather than later.
They're great. I almost kind of get a Neil Young vibe from Adam a little bit, just in the sense that he's on guitar. He's got a great voice. He's got skills playing wise, and he takes the reins from the get-go, and it's just all about Adam. But the, you know, the backing band's amazing, and they're just tons of energy. Yeah. Great show.
Yeah,
which hopefully we can get back to soon, and I can get back to reading your articles on actual live music instead of this bullshit that's going on right now. Man, come on, can't you do something about that? Let's go, Eric.
I mean, how do we get that going? I would definitely if I knew a way. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Definitely, you know, kind of seeing how things are.
Well, thanks so much for telling me all about what's happening and bringing us on board. And one more thing I had down here. I don't want to regress here, digress. We can regress if you want, but not digress too far. But one of your shows that you mentioned that you grew up on was Cow Palace, 74 Cow Palace show.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great. One of my favorite ones, Dick's Picks something. I'm not really sure exactly what.
Dick's Picks 24. Yeah. Cow Palace, 74.
There you go, man.
Debut, if not right at the beginning of the Wall of Sound. Yeah.
You know the Phil bomb that's in that China,
the
China cat, right?
Classic. Oh my God.
That, bombs away. And, and I had a good friend of mine was at that show, and he said the roof was actually blown off of that venue.
Amazing. Oh my God. Yeah. I think a lot about, Bob Weir's like playing or, you know, as they're playing the intro into Deal on that one, Bob Weir's like, you can sure tell who got their tickets over on the radio or something, you know, that's the banter I remember from it. And,
everyone remembers the good banter.
There's a really there's a really good, sequence that they only did a few times, of playing Uncle John's do Uncle John's playing the old do sandwich.
Good stuff, man.
Yeah.
We are everywhere. Good job, man.
Cool.
Well, thanks, Eric, for spending time with me and bringing me up to speed as to, you know, what you're seeing. And, you know, you've been involved in so many amazing stories and people. And wow, I'm so incredibly impressed at the work that you do. And
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you and kind of go deep on the live industry. It's fun to talk about hope of a future where we're able to go back to shows again, you know.
Yeah, let's do this in a couple more months down the road, 6 months down the road, and we'll be talking, having a whole different conversation, hopefully.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Right on. Yeah, thanks for being here, man. Take care. Hey, everyone. Okay, that was Eric Renner Brown, editor at Polestar. And if you stuck around for this long, you really you learned that, hey, in a short, brief 4 to 5 weeks, tons of things can change. We even talked about Chris Stapleton in that interview, and he has since canceled his show at Wrigley and pushed it forward to 2022. Some decisions that needed to be made in the late April, early May timeframe just couldn't be made in time to have those shows in place. It's happened with Chris Stapleton. It's happened with others that had a full capacity crowd to take care of, but when they had to make a decision, they were unable to guarantee full capacity. So, you know, what are they going to do? They can't double the dates to accommodate both to accommodate the entire crowd on two different nights. So probably best that they move those to 2020. Now, when I'm talking to you, present day, you know, it's looking like we're getting shows back early fall timeframe. Fall tour schedules look incredibly full, and there's festivals even starting as early as mid to late August, even early August in a Lollapalooza world. So it's a changing world. It was great to have Eric here to talk about what his perspective is, to sense how badly he wants to get back to reporting on live shows. But he was also able to shift gears. And of course, we talked a little bit about live streaming and how that's going to probably be a part of our lives going forward in the live music industry. I've seen shows, I've been to shows already where there's been a live and a recorded component to stream those shows to people at home that either couldn't make it for whatever reason. It's an extra revenue stream for venues. It'll be interesting for fans to be able to take advantage of that. And if venues already have that equipment, then it's really kind of not a lot of cost to produce those shows in a video format and put that out to people that can't make it. So the world's changing. We'll all be back to shows soon enough, I hope. Let's hope that vaccinations prevent the latest variants from breaking through, and there are no breakthrough infections. So get out there, get vaccinated, tell everyone to get vaccinated. We're getting back to shows pretty soon. I'm psyched about it. And I'm grateful for people like Eric that get out there and report back and talk to everyone and bring back all the news from out there. And I can't wait for him to start reporting on live shows and get back to live shows myself. So I know everyone shares that sentiment as well, and I'm right there. So soon enough. Thanks again for being here on Roadcase. Follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. Thanks again for your support. Don't forget to subscribe and to rate and review Roadcase. And thanks again to Eric Renner Brown for being here on this episode of Roadcase. Thanks again so much for listening. And I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Roadcase. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. And we have a YouTube channel called Roadcase Podcast. And if you are able to and like to support Roadcase, we have a Patreon site at patreon.com/roadcasepod. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Roadcase. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.